I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Today, it's a highlight reel of Fronteras in 2018. Looking back in our archives, one of my favorite stories featured a San Antonio high school class that was learning about Mexican-American literature. Stevens High School teacher Andres Lopez offers his class as an elective, and he doesn't go into each semester with a set syllabus or agenda.
The students and I, we create as a group, what is this class? What does it do for us? Why does it matter? And with their voice and a little bit of guidance from me, we've come up with some pretty compelling things, and slowly, word's getting out.
And Lopez has no shortage of champions for his class, thanks to his enthusiastic students. Other than learning about Chicano literature, art, and film, the students surprisingly found themselves connecting to their culture. Here's senior Silvia Garcia.
When I first came into class, I thought it was just going to be strictly like literature. And I thought we were just going to read, and it was going to be like a normal, like, English class, but mixed with like the Mexican-American thing. And then as time went on, I learned that it was like everyone's story that could like relate was put into play with what we were learning, and it was like very easy to like express like my family's background and how I am and how like the other people in my class is.
Senior Melissa Reyna made an even more personal connection.
I feel like this class added, just gave me a closeness to my grandparents because I kind of learned what it was like to be an immigrant, like whenever you first come, through the stories that we read, like how hard it can be and how you just really want to support your family. Like my grandfather dropped out of school whenever he was in the fifth grade to work in like a factory to support like all of his siblings. So I feel like, I don't know, it just kind of made me almost want to tear up reading some of the stories, like, wow, this is really what it was like for him.
After a lengthy battle, the Texas Board of Education approved a Mexican-American Studies course this year, calling it Ethnic Studies, Mexican-American Studies, making it a core course, no longer subjecting it to elective status. More fascinating conversations I had this year garnered a rare two-part interview. Arizona resident Francisco Cantu is a former Border Patrol agent turned writer. His book, The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border, has earned rave reviews for its inside perspective of the ethical struggles faced by Cantu while with the agency.
You know, I remember it was our second day in the field, I think. We were fresh out of the Border Patrol Academy, and I think a sensor went off, and we picked up the footprints and followed them up from the border road and ended up walking maybe 3 miles or something. And it was a group of marijuana smugglers, and they kind of dumped their marijuana bundles and scattered off into the mountains way ahead of when we got there. So when we came up, there was just these backpacks. There was these bundles of marijuana and then these backpacks full of food and water and cigarettes. And I remember just sort of standing back and watching how our training agent just sort of like let everybody go loose. And people were kind of rummaging through the backpacks, smoking the cigarettes that they found, stepping on the food, you know, throwing the clothes, just like scattering the clothes on ocotillo and cactus. And, you know, at the time, you're not in a position to really do anything other than like sit back and watch. But I think, you know, years later, when I started taking things out of my journal and looking at them and thinking about this book, being kind of jarred by that in a way that I wasn't in the moment.
Cantu served in the Border Patrol between 2008 and 2012. In San Antonio's 300-year history, there's still no shortage of hidden history waiting to be discovered. Landscape architect Everett Fly, who humbly does not call himself a historian, began to uncover bits and pieces about African American history in Bexar County while appointed to the City of San Antonio's Historic and Design Review Board.
For example, the gentleman Philippe Eloy, who came from Louisiana to Texas in 1807, we never would have found out about Mr. Eloy without the Spanish archives. And the petition that he filed for his land, the 1817 petition, I have a copy. It's written in Spanish. So I had to dust off my high school Spanish to interpret it and then get some more advanced Spanish speakers to fact check me. And so we found out that Mr. Eloy owned 7 acres, a little bit more than 7 acres of land east of what is now I-37. And it just happens to be in the area I mentioned where the Alamo Dome, and that's how I came across him. But he also, Mr. Eloy, also owned land on the edge of what we now know or recognize as Alamo Plaza. But all that information is, it's in the deed records. Mr. Eloy stayed in San Antonio, of course, until the Battle of the Alamo, and his property, of course, was so close to the battle that he had to get out of harm's way. So he and other landowners, his neighbors, evacuated. A group of them went to Nacogdoches, which is northeast of here in far northeast Texas, but that would have been the other major colonial settlement, Spanish colonial settlement. So they went to Nacogdoches to ride out the battle, as they say. But by the time Mr. Eloy got back, some of his land had been confiscated, and then he petitioned again to get it back and wound up receiving more than 2,000 acres along the Guadalupe River in Guadalupe County.
And an interesting side note, Philippe Eloy, the gentleman Everett Fly is referencing in this clip, was the first person, black or otherwise, to shed blood in the Texas Revolution. Skipping ahead to mid-year, a story about self-identity and the horrors of the Holocaust was brought to life by Jennifer Tiga. Tiga, who's black, was adopted at a young age by a white German family. As a child, she still had loose, tenuous ties to her birth mother and grandmother. A random trip to the library as an adult led to her opening a book written by her birth mother, Monica Goethe, called I Have to Love My Father, Don't I? Monica's father was notorious concentration camp commandant Amon Goethe, made famous in Steven Spielberg's film Schindler's List.
That was so surreal, because imagine, I mean, what I did after I finished reading the book cover to cover. I did research on the internet because I wanted to verify everything that was written in the book was reality, or maybe that was just fiction, I didn't know. While I did the research, I made the discovery that there was a movie shown on German TV. It was shown for the very first time just hours after I came from the library. The movie is Inheritance. And in that movie, my biological mother, Monica, meets with the survivor. The survivor's name is Helen Rosenzweig, and those who watched the movie Schindler's List know her because she was the maid who lived in the household of Amon Goethe. And you can see in that documentary these two women who meet for the very first time. It's very, very emotional because the situation itself is difficult, but you can also, when you see Helen back, they meet in the villa where Helen lived for all these years next to the concentration camp, you can still see the fear in her eyes, and it's such a powerful movie. And in that documentary also, for example, you would see the execution of Amon Goethe. He was executed after the war. He was hanged. But what was also, for me at least, interesting was I would see my mother after all these years. I haven't seen her since I was 7 years old. This was the last time that we had contact. So more than 30 years had passed. And I saw my mother for the very, very first time again in that documentary. Yeah, it was actually it was not a twofold shock. It was a threefold shock on that day.
Tiga wrote about her struggles coming to terms with her family history in her book, My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, A Black Woman Discovers Her Family's Nazi Past. When we come back, more highlights from Fronteras 2018. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Today we're reviewing some of this year's 2018 highlights from the show. The photo that humanized this year's controversial family separation immigration policy was that of a 2-year-old Honduran girl in a bright pink jacket and pink sneakers, crying uncontrollably. The picture is shot from ground level as the toddler looks up at her mother, who's speaking with a U.S. Customs and Border Protection official. That picture was taken by John Moore, a staff photographer and special correspondent for Getty Images. I had a chance to talk with Moore while he was in San Antonio promoting his photo book, Undocumented: Immigration and the Militarization of the United States-Mexico Border. Our conversation took place about a month prior to his having taken that viral picture. Moore has covered undocumented migration on both sides of the border from every angle for 10 years.
It's a constant threat for photojournalists and reporters trying to cover the story, not just of immigration, but of drug trafficking especially. And as we've seen, many of the same smuggling networks for drugs are now in control of human smuggling as well. And so it's dangerous not just for the journalists that are covering it, but of course for the immigrants who have to come up through that perilous system. Now, part of my coverage was of the journey of people coming up, and I address that really in the second chapter of this book, people coming up on top of train tops known as La Bestia, or walking long distances. And people, depending on where they come from, whether it's Honduras or Guatemala or somewhere in Mexico, they pay different prices to smugglers to bring them up. It's a lot of money, really, for anyone, though, down there. $8,000, $5,000 maybe on the lower end, $12,000, $15,000 on the higher end. And depending what you pay, you'll get a different type of service that brings you up. In Mexico, if you pay on the high end, you may end up traveling in private cars. You may come through tunnels under the U.S.-Mexico border. You may actually get through an official port of entry, whereas those who pay much less to smugglers, they get much more difficult treatment along the way. And the smugglers will oftentimes abandon them in any moment where there's danger, and oftentimes people will end up lost on vast ranches, not knowing which way to go. And really under the summer sun in this part of the country, northern Mexico and along the Texas-Mexico border, it's you don't last long without water in that environment.
John Moore's photo book, Undocumented: Immigration and the Militarization of the United States-Mexico Border, documents 10 years worth of stories told in single frames, from devastated families whose children were killed by cartels and gangs to the sicarios, the assassins who carry out the cartel death sentences, to immigration officials. The episode that saw the most web traffic this year was an interview that aired in September, having to do with the 1918 Porvenir massacre and the controversy over a historical marker commemorating the killings. On January 28, 1918, 15 residents of the West Texas border town of Porvenir were taken to a nearby hill in the middle of the night, shot and killed. They were men and boys, ages 15 to 72, and the perpetrators were a company of Texas Rangers, U.S. Cavalry soldiers, and area ranchers. The common story is that the killings were a response to a Christmas Day raid on the nearby Bright Ranch carried out by Villistas, militants who sided with the Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa. But Monica Munoz Martinez, an assistant professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, says racism was the real reason behind the massacre.
In my research, what I've found is that actually the context for this event is not the raid that happened a month earlier, but it's a decade of anti-Mexican violence that was sanctioned by the state. It was a period in which any person who looked Mexican, whether they were an American citizen or an ethnic Mexican, could be called a bandit or being accused even of being a bandit sympathizer, and they could be murdered without assailants risking prosecution. So there was a culture of impunity. And so what you see in the case of the Bodmini massacre is that this case is different because the survivors, the widows, the grandfathers of the men, the children of the men and the boys that were murdered, sought justice. And so they, following the massacre, they fled to Mexico and sought the support of the Mexican government. And so Mexican soldiers, Mexican diplomats took their statements. And for a series of months, the Mexican government pressured the United States government. They sent, you know, these testimonies. They sent the records of this, their investigations to the U.S. State Department. And that called for the U.S. State Department to pressure the Texas government to investigate the massacre. And so in the months following, you find reports by Texas Rangers, by Anglo vigilantes that participated in the massacre, to cast suspicion on these residents, to call them bandits, to call them squatters. And from the archival work that I've done, you know, those reports were false. But it's taken 100 years of efforts by the survivors and by the descendants to have a truthful accounting of this massacre told. And so the context of a violent period, the context of, by some, that there were raids happening in the region, in my opinion, as a historian of this period, really is an attempt to mitigate the violence.
Controversy simmered this summer and fall over a historical marker to commemorate the Porvenir massacre. It had already been approved by the Texas Historical Commission before it was abruptly withdrawn. We were told by a member of the Presidio County Historical Society that misspellings were discovered in the marker's text, so it was being sent back for corrections. Other voices argued that residents of the region and people in power deny that the events that took place in Porvenir constituted a massacre. A marker was finally dedicated in nearby Marfa on November 19th. Porvenir itself no longer stands. After the massacre, the residents fled across the border in fear of their lives, and the town was razed by soldiers. The massacre now has been publicly recognized, but some descendants still feel deprived of justice. And lastly, one of the more fascinating conversations I had this year was with Carl Jacoby and Chip Williams. Jacoby, a professor of history at Columbia University, wrote a book that unveiled, layer after layer, the curious and complex life of William Henry Ellis, the Texas slave who became a Mexican millionaire. Ellis was born in Victoria just before Juneteenth, when slaves in Texas were emancipated. His light complexion and proximity to Mexican workers on the Victoria cotton fields gave him a way out of a life of Jim Crow that awaited him in the U.S. Ellis reinvented himself as Guillermo Enrique Eliseo, a Mexican, Cuban, or Hawaiian businessman. His identity varied depending on the occasion and on the geography. Chip Williams is Ellis's great-grandnephew.
He really walked the razor's edge in that respect because he had to maintain in his brain, like, okay, in Texas, this is who I am. In New York, this set of people, they think I'm a Hawaiian, and these other people think I'm Cuban. And in Mexico, I have this other persona. I think that that must have been tremendously straining after a while. I ask myself, did he just go with the flow and allow people to assume that he was a Cuban, assume that he was Hawaiian, and he went with that. And then he had to maintain it all, you know, once he got going. It took, I'm sure, a phenomenal level of intelligence to even conceive of carrying out the things that he did and having the guts to, you know, someone born in slavery, someone who grew up picking cotton, then transforms himself in such a revolutionary way to have a self-image that he can project into action that way is just unbelievable, you know, really.
And Carl, you point out in your book that Ellis had quite a survival instinct going on, because at this time in Ellis's life, it was also a very tumultuous political period in Mexico, changes of leadership and upheavals, etc. And Ellis would end up having to change his political leanings according to who was in power in order to sort of stay on top. That's another kind of juggling that he had to do as well.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, he initially, his rise in sort of to prominence, he's closely allied with people in the Porfiriato, or the circle around Porfirio Diaz. But then the Mexican Revolution comes and throws all that into question, and there's a lot of competing factions. And he does this, again, remarkable high wire act of working at first with one coalition and then with another coalition. And I do think it's another almost form of passing. It's just a sort of, he's very good at allowing people to see what they want to see about him, and that he can become what people want him to become. And he takes that same skill that I think had served him so well in the past when he's navigating all the complexity of being in Texas, and then he's able to do that during the Mexican Revolution as well.
Carl Jacoby is the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas slave who became a Mexican millionaire. Thanks for joining us for some of the highlights from the past year. Our year-end recap isn't over yet. Next week, to start off a new year, we'll highlight some of my favorite arts stories of 2018. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Fernando Ortiz Jr. is our editor, and Vince Kong is our digital editor. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. You can find the episodes highlighted today and other shows on our website at tpr.org. You can also find Fronteras wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Happy New Year!